What now?
And we're live.
Oh, well, that was graceful. Very nice.
Yes, wow. Of course.
We are welcome. On top of it today, folks.
The welcome, Klingon everyone, is sick.
To another episode of All Things Trek, where everything is fine, nothing is broken. Yeah, Grace, how was Geek Girl Con? Let's move along with this with a non sequitur.
Oh, man, where to begin? It was amazing. Of course, you were there, so you know that it was a wonderful environment. It was very friendly, very uncreepy. Lots of people felt comfortable enough to, you know, bring their kids, which is a pretty good sign of them feeling like this is a family friendly and a hospitable environment. And it really was. And I think we had a great time doing the panel. We definitely had a great time planning for it. The theme was women in charge, how women in authority are treated in Star Trek.
Yeah, that was the panel was called A Woman's Place is on the Bridge, and it was an excellent panel in a very fun con. I was at the con like all day Saturday, going from panel to panel to panel to panel. And so like I didn't, you know, I had like no time to stop and like look at anything. I was just like, man, there's so many panels I want to see. I loved you guys. Like it was Grace and Jera and Jera's friend Tanya and a woman named Jamala, who is also
Jamala is fantastic. She's one of the old school Star Trek nerds.
And there's also she's also a reporter for our local public radio station. So that was where I knew her from. I had no idea she was a Trekkie, so that was pretty cool. And the only problem with your guys' panel was that it needed to be another 2 hours long.
Oh, I know, right? There was so much left that we wanted to discuss that we just had to be like, okay, we have to pare this down to the bare minimum, otherwise we will be here all day. Which is sad, because then there's a lot of characters that we didn't really get the chance to talk about. We tried to go for, like, the big main ones, but there was so much more to talk about. I really wish we'd gotten to have more time, but it really was just so fantastic.
I gotta say, when everyone was like favorite characters, I was surprised that you went with Admiral Nichea. That was interesting to me.
Again, I gotta have respect for her as a character. I kind of love the, if you can pardon my language, the non-apologetic bitch attitude that we get to see with her. And I think she embodies it so perfectly that you do not run an organization like Starfleet through being nice and being afraid to step on people's toes.
Well, fair enough. You also had another excellent panel that was, I believe it was called Not So Strange Appetites, Women in Horror, I think is what it was called.
Women in the Horror Fandom, yeah, talking about women who love horror and why we love it.
Because it's scary, yo. No,
because wonderful.
That was another excellent panel. I hope that you will be back next year, because I will certainly. And
Oh, you won't be able to keep me away next year.
Right, I mean, and like you pointed out, it's a very friendly environment. Like, there was lots of really cool cosplay. There was more diversity than I've seen at other cons. People brought their children, which means, you know, emergency snacks if you get really hungry. You know, it was just great. Everything was fantastic.
It was a very fun, a very open environment. And please tell me you saw the little girl in the Groot costume who was walking around with flower pots on her feet.
Of course I did. I would never miss that.
Oh my gosh, it was so cute!
She is Groot. Now,
it was amazing.
So I absolutely love Geek Girl Con. I would totally recommend it to anyone who is either near Seattle or is one of those people who is willing to make trips to go to conventions. It's not a huge con. Like, I think this was its biggest year yet, and it was like 7,500 people.
Yeah, but at the same time, having it stay kind of small keeps it a very intimate environment and gives you a chance to, you know, get around and chat up everybody. And I feel like I was able to make contact with just about everyone who I wanted to, and it was great. It was a great size.
Yeah.
No, so, I definitely heard about it, but I wasn't sure. Is this the first year? Has it been going before? How long is it?
I think this was its fourth year, wasn't it?
Fourth? Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds about right.
I only heard about it, like, last year. By the time I heard about it, it was too late to get tickets. Or, like, it was too late for me to arrange my schedule so I could go, really. But this year, I was like, no, I am going this year. So I, you know, planned ahead, and then my plan ahead completely failed because I got there and had not bought tickets, even though I have a very, very clear memory of buying tickets. I could not find a receipt email. They had no record. So a very terrifying few minutes. I thought I wasn't going to get to go. but they had like a couple of weekend passes left. So I was like, give to me. I will buy them all. So that was what happened. That was my adventure at Geek Girl Con. It was, you know, it was a fantastic time. Now, moving on to the next section of the show, we have an email from, speaking of Jera, who was on the panel with you, Grace. This would be Jera Hodge, the Trekkie feminist, who's been on the show a couple of times. And she has sent us an email titled Listener Mail with a smiley face. Hey guys, I just finished listening to your TOS Troubles episode and thought it was fabulous. I really appreciated the connections you and the guests made between the scenes where McCoy hits Aline in Friday's Child and the real-world issues with men's sense of entitlement over women's bodies. Side note, yeah, that scene is still creepy, and it's hard to watch. I also appreciated when you were talking about how it's hard to know where the sexism in TOS came from. Was it Roddenberry, NBC, certain writers, etc.? I wanted to recommend Mark Cushman's These Are the Voyages. I've just started reading Volume 2, which covers Season 2 of TOS, and Volume 1 was excellent. Cushman had access to all the Roddenberry memos, so he goes through each episode's script each day of filming and talks about who changed what. If anything, it just shows there was no one source for the sexist problems in TOS. Every single episode went through a lot of hands and a lot of memos were exchanged, and sometimes problematic elements were added by a particular writer, or by Roddenberry, or by a request from NBC, or from one of the other producers. There's a lot of good insight. Excuse me, got to scroll down. It's a lot of good insight on Friday's Child and how exactly Jean changed DC Fontana's original screenplay, which was intended to be a women's lib story, her words. Although when you read more about her plans, I'm not entirely sure her intended message would have gotten through. Live long and prosper, Jera. So that's another reason I have to pick up These Are the Voyages. I've been looking at that for a while now. It's been getting very good reviews.
David, and again, Jera was one of my co-panelists, and she is the Trekkie feminist, and she is just amazing.
David, have you heard about These Are the Voyages at all? Do you know anything about it?
Yeah, actually, I was able to interview Mark Cushman at Star Trek Las Vegas, and then halfway through it, David Gerald sat down because he also has Ooh. Some involvement. And it's definitely, I heard about it. We covered it for the first book, and now at last, you know, this year, earlier this year at Vegas 2014, he was there for the second volume, and the third one is coming soon. I think it should be out in either November or December. He said it was in the final polishing, and it should be out. I definitely want to get it. I haven't been able to pick it up, the first one, yet, but I'm definitely wanting to get the set when the third one comes out, because it's not only Gene Roddenberry's personal like notes and letters, and he also like paid money to get ratings info from, you know, the Nielsen, and sometimes you make requests and they say, oh, we don't have that, we don't give that out. But when you start putting out, say, well, I'll commission it, which means, you know, I'll pay for it. Then, oh, yeah, we found it. Or, oh, yeah, okay, we could do that.
What you're telling me is that the Nielsen's ratings are like, my memory's so fuzzy. If you could give me, like, maybe if I could talk to the Benjamins, then I could maybe remember a little bit. Wow, right. That is shady.
This is a nice show you got here. It'd be a shame if we couldn't find out what people think of it.
Grease the wheels of the memory, but you know, and it's also all across the board. It's like unprecedented access to behind the scenes info. Some of the stuff that, you know, the studios and other people may not have wanted to get out, or, you know, were reluctant, but it's definitely, everybody should pick it up. Definitely each episode, every season, all across the board, like I said, David Gerald, up to Leonard Nimoy, of saying, this is the real deal. This is never before. Things you thought, you know, you knew about Trek, some of it is you didn't know the full story and it goes deeper. Other things were, myth and believed. But then when he's doing the digging, it's actually different. So, yeah, definitely everybody should pick up These Are the Voyages. And I think the second one is out, and I'm looking forward to the whole set.
I know we have a question for Grace from the chat room. Our friend Curious the Queer has asked Grace, hey, Grace, played Delta Rising yet? It's Voyager that's neither stupid or annoying.
I have not yet, but I'm super excited to. I'm psyching myself up by watching through Voyager to get ready to play it. I'm very excited to see what they have to offer and what the crew of Stowe has got in store.
It was really
I will
funny.
Definitely be giving my feedback, though.
It was really funny watching you watch Voyager, because you, like, you got to Warlord, which is the episode where, like, Kes is empowered by Space Hitler to break up with Neelix. But they're, like, it was kind of funny, because they're not super clear that they're broken up. It's like Kes breaks up with Neelix, but she was, like, possessed when she did it. And they never have, like a scene afterwards where they're like, yeah, we're broken up. They never confirm or deny it. So a couple episodes later, you were like, wait, are they broken up? When did that happen? Not that anyone.
That's true.
Not that anyone is complaining about Kes and Neelix not being together. Just the way they did it was kind of odd.
Definitely odd. I really would have expected more when so much of this relationship is based on the fact that they're in a relationship together. Well, not their relationship being based on that, but their characters based on each other. It was surprising, definitely.
All right. So now it is time to continue our topic from 2 weeks ago. We are talking about the reoccurring villains of Star Trek. And so we got through TOS and TNG. So this week we should get through about half of Deep Space Nine, I'm guessing. So the first villain I think we need to talk about is Keiko O'Brien. But not actually.
Wait. Wah, wah, wah.
You mean with the Paw Wraith or without? Or wait, that's spoilers for those who haven't. Well, but that does address that there were some characters that started in Next Generation and went over to DS9. And of course, we love that O'Brien got a bigger role instead of just manning the transporter. But there were a couple of, you know, nefarious, villainous type characters that made that transition as well.
Yeah, so actually the first one that is interesting is Gowron. And it's sort of, Gowron is a very interesting character because he gets introduced really early in TNG, and then he's there like throughout TNG, throughout DS9, until almost the very end of Deep Space Nine. And like, he starts off, he's not really a villain, he's kind of a weird foil, and then he's kind of an ally, and then he eventually becomes a villain with the Klingon fight in season 4 of Deep Space Nine, and then he becomes an ally again to fight the Dominion, and then Worf has to fight. God, Gowron is a complicated character, David.
Yeah, and I in a way I think he's, I wouldn't say he's the best example of, like, you know, virtuous Klingon, honorable type of, you know, in that way. But
definitely not.
But on the other hand, it's kind of like he is a very good example of a Klingon, and a special, not just in general in one way, but also he wasn't a general, like, okay, we see General Chang in the movie, we see General Martok later, we never really hear General Gowron. It was just, he's introduced as somebody right off the bat. He wasn't exactly, you know, the most virtuous, most honorable example to hold up as, like, this is a quintessential honorable Klingon. And also, he wasn't just a military person, right? Because we saw General Chang, and he had his own issues about, you know, his what he was doing. Was that honorable? Was it not? Was it, you know, doing a bad thing for what he thought was a good reason? So that's General, you know, General Chang, but he's a military person, he's a general. Then later on we get General Martok, but that just shows, like, we get shown them in the light of they're a military, you know, general. Gowron, the first time we see him, he's making a bid for the High Council, for the chancellorship against Duras, and that's what, you know, they have to decide who's going to get the seat, and that's when Worf names Chadich, you know, Picard as Chadich. Oh, Grace is coming back. Hang on a second. Get her back into the channel. So, but what you said, though, about how he went from villain, well, not even starting off as a villain, that Gowron kind of started off as a person that you didn't really, you know, love or hate or trust or distrust. He was introduced as, he's just a person, you know, a Klingon warrior, Klingon going for the High Council. So in a way, you could kind of say politician, maybe. But then, of course, he goes through all these arcs. And that's why what I was saying is, he's a good example of a Klingon, because almost like stories about certain Native American individuals or even nations where like they go where the good fight is. And so on for one period of time, they're allies with a certain group, and then, you know, time goes on, things change, climate change, and then they're enemies with that person, and then they may be allies. So it was kind of like he was a good example of somebody who went with the politics or the political, you know, social situation, where when it was good for them to be in cahoots with the Federation, when it was mutually beneficial, or at least beneficial to the Klingons, he would do it. But then any time that it kind of was either not beneficial or they didn't agree with it, they would, you know, break that alliance. And so Gowron was a good example of the kind of the gray area, where it's like he didn't really do anything super just outright dishonorable to the point of going, like, he's going to Grethor, kind of like the way we see the Duros people are always shown to be, like, you know, you can't trust them, they're definitely on the the dark side, quote unquote, to mix metaphors or go to another franchise with it. But Gowron was an interesting character that I would definitely say at times he could be qualified as a villain, but then political and, you know, social things happen and change, and then he's back to being neutral, at least, or sometimes an ally. And that's a different scenario than what we see with Martok, and that's why I would not really say Martok ever would fit into the villain category, even though there was times with the Dominion War and the Klingon Cardassian War and the Federation, all that scenario, that Martok, you know, there was a time he was not the ally of the Federation, but I don't think that would qualify, he would be categorized as the villain the same way Gowron was, because Gowron definitely had politics and, you know, bureaucracy and power in mind. And whereas Martok, he was a military general, but he came up from like the commoner, the, you know, the lowlands, the Kethil lowlands, came up through the ranks of through the military and then became chancellor, but he never sought power and, you know, influence to that the same way that Gowron did. So Gowron's right in that weird little area where I would say he's a villain for some point, some duration, you know, some segments, but then other times he is not the exactly a villain, but he's definitely somebody that, you know, they would have to contend with and go to war with, and especially Worf, where Worf is a lot of times trapped between two worlds, and that's another issue that, you know, is a theme or something that Native Americans have to deal with, of like walking two roads, being in two worlds or two cultures type of thing. And so from Worf's perspective, there was definitely times where he would think of Gowron as the enemy or the villain. But in a greater, grander scheme of things, you know, Gowron was doing what he wanted. You know, he's trying to get power and glory for himself and the Empire. He was doing what he thought was good for the Empire. It wasn't just like twisting the mustache going, ha ha ha, I'm going to put the woman on the railroad tracks.
Gowron is a great example of when a character shows you the difference between a villain and someone who is just an antagonist. He's an antagonistic character, to be sure. He goes up against our main characters a lot, but at the same time, he's got this sort of morality shades of gray thing where he's a jerk, no denying it, but you can't say he's wrong a lot of the time, except when he, you know, definitely is.
Right, and the thing that makes Gowron, like, the most interesting part about Gowron to me, as when he is in the antagonist role, is that he has a great chemistry with Worf, in that he is the gatekeeper.
Absolutely.
Of what Worf wants, right? Because Worf, his like driving character motivation for most of Worf's story is to be accepted as Klingon. And Gowron has that power.
And personal honor, not so much glory and fame to like, oh, they're going to sing songs about me. But Worf trying to achieve that is more about personal power, where Gowron would have been more about, you know, glory and fame or whatever for the in a military for the Empire.
So there's a duality there also that makes us want to see more of the character, definitely.
Yeah, and because Gowron he can grant Worf what Worf has always wanted. Like, he gives, and at first he does. Like, when Worf supports him in the Civil War, he rewards Worf and is like, Worf, your house is reinstated, your brother has a seat on the High Council, etc. And then Worf is forced to realize that the person who has given him, you know, this boon that he's always wanted is now plunging the Quadrant into war, which he doesn't want, and he has to break with Gowron. But then, like, Gowron is very tantalizing. He's like, hey, Worf, you could have it all back. You know, you could be rehabilitated in Klingon society. And eventually, Worf has to do away with him. He's just like, you have caused too much damage, and we have that really great duel between Worf and Gowron. And I'm not normally a huge fan of the way that Klingon, like, progression is shown, where it's like, if you are good enough at fighting, you can kill your way to the top. But I thought that worked very, very well. I really enjoyed it.
Well, and now it's another example where it was in a structured, ritualistic format. It wasn't just, you know, a burly brawl of, like, whoever, like, everybody just fights, and whoever is standing at the end, they're the king. It's not a situation like that. And just a quick side note, like, when they say, you know, on a Klingon ship, you know, kill your way to the captain, there's a structure and a hierarchy to that, a format that a lowly ensign can't just go kill the captain and then say, I'm the captain now. Like, there's a format and a hierarchy and all. But in the case of Worf and Gowron, when Worf was fighting Gowron, it wasn't, again, like, he didn't hate Gowron. It wasn't that he was trying to say, I just want the chancellorship. It was about upholding the principles of honor, and each of them had their own interpretation or their view of it. But the good example or contrast is Gowron with, like, the shades of gray and, you know, the going back and forth between ally and not an ally. A good contrast to that is the Duras sisters, because they obviously started with the Next Generation and the Duras storyline with Worf. But then they cross over to DS9, and they make at least one appearance. I think they might make two. But just the fact that they, you know, even if it is only one appearance on DS9, they reoccur in a way because they come over from TNG. So that was a scenario where, like, they're always just out for themselves. They're not trying to, you know, do what's best for the Empire, even if their view of what would be best for the Empire might be skewed. They just want personal. They just want personal riches, personal glory and influence, and, you know, that's why, and they're going to basically do whatever they can to get there. That's why they'll work with the Romulans. They'll do, you know, they'll hire assassins where, you know, that may not be the most honorable thing in Klingon society. So that was just an interesting continuation of their characters.
And again, that's the really great sort of contrast between Gowron and the Duras sisters as villains. They are very much that, yeah, we're in this for us. There's a little bit of mustache twirling in there and everything. And with Gowron, again, it's kind of ambiguous. He's not necessarily the villain, but he's definitely not the good guy. He's a complicated character, and he's a complicated antagonist, and that's what makes him so interesting.
Yeah, and with the, like you guys basically just said, with the Duras sisters, like, the reason that the Duras sisters are in Deep Space Nine is to kind of remind people they exist, because they were going to be in the movie, and I have my own issues with the way they were presented there. But you're right, is that the Duras sisters are not morally ambiguous, they're just bad guys, and they're out, you know, they're, you know, in it for their own gain to the point of being against, like, everyone else. But another villain in Deep Space Nine, who we have talked about before, but we are going to have to mention here again, because it's very important, who is super ambiguous, is one Gul Dukat. Or as we like to know him sometimes, Mark Alamo's neck. So Gul Dukat is a extremely complicated character. And of course, he is a very bad guy, right? Like, he oversaw if not a genocide, at least a highly targeted, like, violent, oppressive regime, right? Like, he was the head of the Cardassian occupation of Bajor. But at the same time, like, Dukat's entire motivation, and you start to realize this over, this is not immediately clear, right? Because at first it seems like his motivation is that he wants power, he's just, you know, scheming and, like, you know, trying to do whatever Cardassian does. But you realize over the course of the series, that Gul Dukat's, his motivation is that he wants the Bajorans to love him. And he doesn't understand why they hate him. And he thinks there must be something wrong with them. And does anyone else get shivers from that? Just like, ugh!
It is, because that's truly kind of at the risk of making some sort of mental generalization here, it's psychopathic, his logic, and you know that, and it's so creepy. And it's not only creepy in the sense that you're like, wow, that's really messed up, but it makes a lot of sense when you think about historically people who've done horrible things saying, yeah, I was just trying to make things better for these people. I don't understand why they didn't like it. There's a lot of historical analogy to be drawn there, and that makes you as a viewer very uncomfortable.
It's like, yeah, I was just trying to civilize them. I mean, you know, it's, yeah, you killed like most
exactly,
of them.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's just like the...
That's part of the factor.
And of course, that also... You know, go ahead, David.
Well, throughout the whole Cardassian occupation of Bajor and the treatment of the Bajoran people, you know, in general, but also Dukat specifically with Tarok Nor, which is obviously later DS9, I saw so many layers or similarities or, you know, facets where in some ways it reminded me of what happened to the Native Americans with the colonization. Other times it reminded me of you know, internment camps during, like, with what Sulu or what George Takei has talked about, you know, with the Japanese internment camps, that type
of
thing.
We were just trying to protect them, that kind of thing.
Well, just shades of that, but, I mean, just, you know, having them be, in you know, rounded up and oppressed. But a lot of what kind of rung in my, like, the bell most to me was kind of American slavery, because it wasn't just genocide. Obviously, there was elements of that where they were treated so badly that they didn't value the life. Like, that reminded me, you know, like the three-fifths of a human type of thing. But they didn't want to just kill him out, because if it was more like the Native American scenario, it would be like, we want their land or we want their resources, their planet, whatever it would be. So we're just going to wipe them out and get rid of them. It wasn't so much just straight out genocide, because they wanted them to work the mines and, you know, work in the refinement processing. So that's where it kind of was like, put them to work, it worked them till they fall over. But Dukat was in a weird scenario, because you could imagine other Cardassian goals or, you know, people in his position of, you know, other refinement plants, that they would just hate the Bajorans and they would just like totally be as brutal and you know, as possible. Whereas Dukat, obviously he did atrocities and bad things, but in his mind, and we've seen this in certain episodes, he would still do that, but he would have this weird twist on it where it's like he would be like trying to show mercy and trying to be kinder to them than some of the other
that made him unpredictable also.
But it was also that he didn't just have outright hatred for the Bajorans, because he actually fell in love with one or more of them, you know, obviously and that's again back to American presidents had slaves and had relationships. So there's just like so many layers to it, but it was just weird. And that's even like more creepy that he was doing these things, but in his mind thinking he was kind of a more kinder, beneficent version of what would still be a bad atrocities with the occupation. And so that's where it was like, it's just weird that in his mind he thought he was doing, not doing them a favor, but like being better towards them than some of the other Cardassians were from.
Well, sorry.
Well, just the last thought of that is like from the Bajoran perspective or outsiders like the Federation, they're still going to say, but you're doing horrible things. You know, what you think you're doing, that it's not like what you, I don't think it means what you think it means type of thing.
But there's also that whole, and this is what makes the whole plot of the Cardassian occupation of Bajor scary in general, this idea that the agency of the Bajorans as a people was taken away from them by the occupation. And it's treated in the sense that, at least with Dukat, him acting like he's this benevolent father figure, being like, yeah, they didn't know how to take care of themselves, so we started taking care of them for them. And just taking away this entire culture's, what am I trying to say here? Their agency as, you know, as a society, as a culture, and, you know, as adults capable of making their own decisions. And that is such a scary thought in general, the idea that someone with more authority can just sort of say, we didn't think you were being an adult well enough, so we're revoking your privileges. And the fact that he really does think he's being helpful is part of what makes it so scary.
Right, and of course, there's multiple layers to that, right? Because on the one hand, this is one thing that factors into imperialism in real life is the paternalistic factor, right? Where the like
again, yeah,
you would get these weird debates in like the House of Parliament in England during the height of the British Empire, where you had some people who would be like, man, those locals are savages. We should kill them all. And then you have other people being like, well, they are savages, but we shouldn't kill them all. Because is being a savage really their fault? And it's like, oh my god, there's no way out here. This is not a recurring villain, but just to bring this up a little bit, the people in the chat room are talking about Duet. And even though Galdar Heel is not actually in that episode, we get the impression that Maritza, who is pretending to be Galdar Heel, is giving his accurate statement. And so you have Galdar Heel, who was evil, was a terrible person, but he was honest about it. He was like, we needed your resources. You know, we had an empire to build, and we needed to strip mine your planet. That was what we were here for. And then you have Dukat, who has built these layers of self-deception to be like, no, I was helping them. And then even on top of that, you have Gul Dukat's relationship with his daughter, which makes the whole thing like even more complicated with Zial.
Well, and again, the difference with Galdar Heel is he was upfront about it, but also I don't know if he just outright hated the Bajorans, you know, like total straight out racism. But we never, at least from that episode, we never see or hear about him taking a Bajoran wife or having a, you know, that type of thing. Whereas Dukat definitely took a Bajoran, you know, concubine, woman that he, in his mind,
or
he fell in
love.
Right. At least one, right, for Zial. But then he's always after Kira. So it kind of shows that he has, again, it's almost like when a person is racist, but they still have that infatuation with the other, with the people or persons that they're racist against. That's just like twisted and layers to it, where you can't just say like, oh, he just hates all Bajorans, wants them all dead, he's gonna work them till they're, you know, till they're fall over dead. It was just weird. And then we see that he gets taken out of that power position of, you know, Terok Nor, but throughout the whole course of the series, it's kind of like he never really felt like he was defeated. And, you know, you don't see, like, you know, he lost the war, so he's remorseful or anything. It's like you always still have that arrogance of, like, I was there once and I could be in that position of power again. And then obviously we see him, you know, take certain different positions of power, but not the same, you know, running the refinement and the whole station. But it was just weird to see him, like, kind of have remorse in glimpses, like tiny microscopic ways, but then at the same time he would go right back to that position of power and do it again and feel like he was doing a better job of it than these other cards. It was just interesting. So
and
honestly,
that's kind of the definition of madness, doing the same thing and expecting different results.
And, you know, spoiler, I guess, if people haven't seen it, but it's been long enough, so that's why I wasn't surprised when he gets the Paw Wraith in him. You know, it's like, if it was Garrick or if it was Damar or other people, I'd be like, whoa, that's out of left field, or that's out of character, or not expected. Not that I would expect it, but, you know, like, surprising. Whereas Dukat,
it's fitting. Like, it's definitely fitting.
Yeah. So that's another thing. So let's talk about the later parts of Dukat's character, because they did an interesting thing with him where they kind of gave us a bait and switch. They made us think, oh, maybe he's going to be a good guy now because he's like fighting the good fight against the Klingons. They kind of psyched us out to be like, hey, man, maybe he's going to be on your side. And it was like, nope, he's with the Dominion. And then Zial dies and he kind of goes completely off the deep end. Now,
just more ambiguity, which makes him fun and complicated.
I think Dukat should have died at the end of Waltz. Like, Waltz is the episode, for anyone who doesn't remember, where Dukat and Sisko are trapped on the planet, and Dukat is seeing things and going crazy, and that's sort of where all of this, like, I wanted the Bajorans to love me thing comes from. And to me, like, that felt like the end of his story arc. Like, I thought that if he had died in that episode, it would have made a lot of sense, but I'm honestly not a huge fan of Dukat as the space antichrist. Like, that I can see where it fit.
Let me see if this has any bearing, or, you know, if you could agree with this. That basically, after Zial dies, you know, and then, like, the you know, with the waltz, he basically did, you know, the spirit, or however you want to call him, his essence, that at that point, he goes off the deep end from after that, basically. So in a way, you could say, like, he just, I don't know how you would characterize it, like, he didn't give up, but, like, from that point forward, it's a different Dukat. Like, it, you know, he's different in a way. So in one way, the old Dukat was no more, you know, died, quote unquote, and then that's what could have led into being possessed and, you know, going on this whole different path towards a different type of power grab. Does that make any kind of sense? Like,
yeah,
after
it's,
that?
It's not terrible, right? Like, Deep Space Nine writers were still good, and you know, Marco Lemo was still a good actor. What bothered me about it was that Dukat suddenly, he became very uniquely connected to Sisko when he took up the Paw Wraiths, and he had always been, like, Kira's villain before that, and I sort of preferred him that way. Especially.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with you on that, definitely.
Especially, Curiously Queer pointed this out in the chat room, but one thing I forgot to mention that is, like, hugely important in humanizing Dukat is the moment in, I don't remember the name of the episode, but when he sits on the rock needle or whatever it was, it basically just gets a thorn stuck in his ass, and, like, it's this guy, and he's like, he's this terrifying monster, and now he's like,
it's like, oh,
around.
I've got a cut on my butt.
Yeah, he's like hopping around being like, ah, I got stuck by this thing, and but it hurts. Ah, Kira, help me out here. And that scene, it's so funny. And also, like, you know, it's just like, here's it. I appreciate that the Deep Space Nine writers were willing to take their main villain and show him in such, like, an undignified light. It showed that they were confident in their villain.
Definitely.
But
also,
sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
I was actually just going to ask a question. I was going to ask you to elaborate, because it sounded like you had more to say on the issue of Dukat becoming Sisko's villain rather than Kira's villain.
Just that he was kind of a manic villain from the beginning, and they had him jumping around a lot, like, on his moral alignments and which side he was really on, and so I guess it kind of fit to have him, you know, switch who he was the main villain for, but I would have really liked to have seen it, you know, go through with Kira all the way to the end. But at the same time, apparently the writers for a while were convinced that they were going to have him and Kira become, like, an antagonistic couple.
Ew.
Which is so creepy and gross. And
I'm so glad they didn't
maybe,
do that.
Yeah, really glad they didn't do that for many reasons.
In a way, you could see that that Dukat would have wanted that, but Kira would have never went for it. So that's where we kind of get Zial as the like the in between. But he was never so one dimensional that he wasn't just like, oh, he's Kira's foil or villain. Because then there was the whole issues with him and Garak. So then once it gets to the point where he's got this, you know, Paw Wraith in his, you know, in him,
he's everybody's foil.
It would make sense that once he gets possessed by the Paw Wraith and he has, you know, whether the Paw Wraith is controlling him or he's just now got, you know, more, it pushed him more in the direction he was already going in, either way. But once he's got the, you know, Paw Wraith Dukat, I think it would be natural for him to target Sisko because Sisko would be the emissary. And it would be like Dukat thinking, aside from, you know, the station and power over the, you know, the Bajoran people, like, if, you know, he has to shepherd them or whatever, then it would become the celestial temple and, you know, all that stuff. So it would almost be like, again, like with Kai Winn, which we should get to, but Dukat saying, like, going for power in that way, who's this human? He's not, you know, he's just a human, but they're the prophets and the prophets / wormhole aliens and the Bajorans are putting all this, you know, emphasis on Sisko, the emissary, that once he gets the Paw Wraith, that's who his target would be to me. It's like, I don't see him going after, like, ooh, I got the Paw Wraith power, I'm going to go take down Garak. It's like, it seemed natural.
Although that would have been pretty funny.
Yeah, the Paw Wraith has its sights set on bigger fish, I guess.
Morn!
No,
wait.
It's because the Paw Race, no, they couldn't handle Garrett.
Oh, man, can we have that? An ending to Deep Space Nine where Morn was the big guy at the end of everything?
It was all about Morn. So, just because I don't want us to run out of time, we should definitely talk, because I think we're going to be stuck on Deep Space Nine for our next 10 minutes, but we should talk about Kai Winn, at least for a few minutes, because... Yep. Where Dukat is a villain,
good Lord, yes,
super complicated and is like very, like, we don't know. Like, sometimes we like him because he's so charismatic, and sometimes he's just kind of silly, and then other times he's terrifying. God, is Kai Winn someone you love to hate? Like, isn't she? I don't think I'm the only one.
It's the simplicity that makes it so easy, but not in a way that, you know, she's a flat mustache twirling villain again. You understand what she's all about from the beginning. She is someone who is religious but wants power through the politics of religion. And I think you're kind of freaked out by that at the beginning because you realize that's a thing. That's a very real thing in just about every religion to some degree. And the amount of power that, whether you like to acknowledge it or not, religion does have over politics makes her this sort of doubly powerful and scary figure, and the fact that she is just kind of all about that and is totally okay with it makes her scary as hell, man.
Well, and it's on multiple layers again, because for one, she wants the, you know, the power, in meaning influence over the Bajoran people. She wants, you know, the basically to be able to, you know, snap her fingers and make it happen type of thing. Like, she wants that power. But then there's also the level of it where she wants to be at, you know, the personal admired. She wants to be worshipped. Like, so it's partly her ego.
She wants
like,
to be on level with the prophets.
Right. So it's like having like military or governmental power is part of it. But also you could see that her ego, her personality, just wants to be adored and worshipped and, you know, people waiting on her and looking up to her as... And so it's kind of like... And the other thing is, once it goes further into the episodes, you start to see her manipulating thing, you know, people and situations, and then doing a power grab and all that, but...
And later, at one point, doesn't she say, I have no use for prophets who can't grant me anything, or something like that.
Right, that's when it's towards the later part where she's starting to, you know, quote-unquote lose her faith, but kind of go towards the dark side, and that's where she gets involved with Dukat, who's disguising himself as a Bajoran. But even from the very beginning, from season one, when we don't know all of her storyline, like at her best, quote-unquote, you just kind of love to hate her because she's just so arrogant and smug and condescending that, like, it's just, and it's so well acted by Louise Fletcher that every time
she shows up,
it's like every time it's not the character where you're like, oh God, not this again. Like, why are they, you know, like, oh, this is going to be good.
She's a genuine threat. Yeah.
I'm going to hate her.
She's going to stir shit up.
But this is going to be good. Yeah.
And I think also part of what makes her intimidating as a figure is everyone has had to encounter someone like that in their life. A holier-than-thou figure who will totally just crap down your throat in any way they can because it makes them feel powerful. That's scary. That's scary, that's intimidating, and it's evil. It's just, there's no redeeming that.
And, like, one thing that I've always been curious about with Kai Winn is to what extent is her faith legitimate? Like, obviously... She is very, very self-centered, right? Like, we know that. And she basically, when she finds out that the prophets are not in her corner and that she's basically been handed to the Paw Wraiths, she's kind of like, well, she feels bad about it, but then she's like, all right, Paw Wraiths, we can deal with this. But
let's make a deal.
Yeah, like, I have always wondered, like, to what extent she was actually devoted to the prophets before, because we have a couple of indications that she is very devoted in a misguided way, and then in other indications that she doesn't really care about the prophets, that she is basically only using the prophets as a way to gain political authority, which on a planet like Bajor makes sense, because Bajor, the secular government on Bajor is very, very weak and can barely get anything done, And they make it very clear that the Vedic Assembly and the Kai are the real forces for change on Bajor. So, like, it was raised in the chat room. There was this, Shran was asking why she was so willing to turn away from the prophets if she was seen, you know, if she had had this faith and been a Vedic, like, throughout the occupation. Like, that seems odd. So I would kind of wonder if what the implication of that is that her being, is that she was just forward thinking enough to realize that if she stuck with the ideals of being, of the prophets, even in the face of the Cardassians, that when the Cardassians were gone, that would earn her a lot of cred. Like, she wasn't willing to side with the Cardassians.
She was playing the game long term. This was a long con for her.
Right. And like, the reason I think she wouldn't become a collaborator is that the best she could hope for as a collaborator is to be given favors by the Cardassians, right? Like, there was that area, there was no real power for her there. Like, she would be comfortable probably because they would give her stuff, but she wouldn't have any actual authority, which is clearly what she craves.
Well, and there's a lot of times in her, through her character development, where from the very beginning, you almost get the sense where she's like, if I just, like, you know, bide my time, if I just jump through the hoops and stick with it and, you know, go through, you know, the process, that she will get what she wants. She will get the reward. She'll get the respect. And it, like, all across or all throughout, there's little parts that are big, like, moments where you could see that she's expecting that she would be, you know, given the baton to run with it, but it goes to somebody else. And at those moments, she's like, but what about me? Like, I'm supposed to, and that goes with, you know, getting the visions from the prophets, the orb visions, and that she don't get those. You know, she's expecting to be the big religious figure after Kyle Paca, but then here comes the emissary, and now they're looking to Sisko, this other person. It's like every step of the, not every step, but it's like
she's being overstepped by a guy who's not even a Bajoran.
And then, like, Kira gets visions from the orbs and the prophets, and not her. It's like, there's key big moments where it's like you could almost think that in her mind she's like, just wait it out or bide your time or go through the steps and you'll get the rewards and you'll move up the ladder. But there's these moments where it's like it sidesteps her, goes to somebody else, and she gets bitter, and that makes her want to even do the power grab even more. So by the end, I think if you look at Kai Winn, or, you know, Vedic Winn at the very beginning, she's the smug and arrogant, but you could kind of see it's not the same Winn as when she becomes Kai and starts to try to get, you know, more power, more influence. That by that time, it's less about the faith and the religion of it, and it's more about her being in power and control and, you know, people waiting on her every word type of thing. And so by that, when the prophets go to somebody else, and by that time she's like ready to, like, well, I still want the power. Like, the power grab meter has like risen and risen and risen. So by that time she's wanting the power so much more than she was back then that, if I have to go with the paw rates for it, then, you know, that's the direction to go in. But it's still like, it's still part of Bajoran religion. You know what I mean? Even though it's like the opposite end of it or the dark side of it, she's still within the realm of Bajoran faith and religion and dogma, whatever. She's not like saying, well, let me try the Klingon way now. Or, you know, she's like still within the Bajoran faith system, paradigm, whatever you want to call it. But now she's just going to the opposite end of it because that's where the power would be.
Yeah, and one other thing that occurs to me is just as a reason why I think that she was never really that into the faith, and this was almost always a political tool for her, was the episode, I don't remember what it's called, but the episode with the conflict over the school, and it's kind of a metaphor for, you know, teaching, you know, evolution, where she's really upset, and she's yelling at Keiko for teaching the kids that basically refusing to call the wormhole and refusing to call it the celestial temple and refusing to call them the prophets, which honestly,
and it's a semantic thing that could have easily been fixed, but she is just able to blow it out of proportion so quickly.
Right. And honestly,
it's like, whoa, this woman from the very beginning.
Yeah, that conflict always bothered me a little bit because it seemed like Keiko was being unnecessarily obstinate. She was just being like, no, I'm not going to call them the Prophets, even though that seems to be what they call themselves. I'm going to insist on calling them wormhole aliens.
It's almost like Keiko has no real experience teaching a diverse group, or teaching in general.
Yeah, maybe. Just a little bit. But what is interesting to me is that, you know, I could totally buy that someone would do something with misplaced faith and be like, yes, I believe in this faith, therefore I must act out against these people, even in a really silly way. But you'll notice that Kai Winn, she wasn't Kai yet, Winn set up that whole thing to try to get Beryl so she could assassinate him. And then once that's over, she doesn't care. She's not really interested in the school. She's like, yeah, whatever. They can go ahead and teach their blasphemy. Like, this is no longer useful to me as a political tool. I'm going to move on. Which suggests to me that even though she may even have fooled herself into thinking she's at least somewhat faithful, it's not that important to her, you know? That just seems like that's the case. And, of course, we have a few minutes left here. Are you guys up for talking a little bit about Sloane? Because he's another reoccurring villain.
Sure, why not?
Is very interesting before we close out. So Sloane, for anyone who doesn't remember, is the face of Section 31, as we recall it.
And what a face, am I right?
Yeah, I know. And he first appears to Bashir pretending to be an agent of Starfleet Intelligence and questioning him about being a double agent, and then it turns out to be like a recruitment pitch. And then Section 31, of course, being the super secret, like, you know, completely denied agency that doesn't even answer to like the Federation Council or the President. It's just this rogue agency trying to do what they see as best for the Federation. And so that's like that. Sloane is just a very interesting guy because he has like this. He has a certain like assumed moral superiority about him where he's like, all these bad things that I'm doing, they're all for your own good.
Again, that taking away of agency and being like, yeah, we're just gonna kind of repossess your rights here and make them our own, because you can't take care of yourself.
And it's even a little bit further than that, though, because it's not like, Sloane isn't for the most part doing bad things to the main characters, right? Outside of the one episode where he interrogates Bashir, he more or less leaves them alone. It's that he is going off and doing things in the name of the Federation that they find abhorrent. Like, he is going off and he is arranging for the death of a Romulan senator who has done nothing wrong, and he's doing this because it will, in his mind, further Federation interests. And he and Section 31 are setting up a genocidal disease on the Founders because they see that that will serve, they think that that will serve the Federation's interest.
And all in the name of the greater good.
The greater good. Yeah, so, and it's, you could question their logic, like, you could question whether or not that's actually going to help the Federation, practically speaking, but it's very interesting to have a villain who is saying, no, guys, I'm on your side. These babies that I'm killing, they're to help you. You're just, you know, don't worry, you keep doing what you're doing. I got your back, man. And it's like, there's a bit of a...
Hey, buddy, I'm your friend here. You would never turn your back on your friend, would ya? Like a drug dealer, but with political influence.
That's just a good storytelling twist to where, like, the person... Because normally you think the villain... You know, quote unquote, the villain and the black hat in the old cowboy days of like, he's the one that's doing the bad things for, you know, bad reasons or doing what he thinks might be a good reason, but they're bad things. In this case, that person is on your side, like wearing your same uniform, your same, you know, nationality or your same whatever it is, you know, allegiance type of thing. So it's like, it's just a weird, interesting, cool twist on it that, like, the villain, like you said, is not the other team or the other government or the other race or whatever. It's like from within your own group. But another one,
adding
that popped
shades
up,
of gray to the whole mess.
And now let me ask if this, because I would definitely consider him to be a villain or like the bad guy based on his, you know, principles, philosophy, actions, and all that. What about, you know, I was trying to think also other reoccurring people that were like antagonist or villain, but then I thought, well, is this person really a villain? What do you think about Eddington and his whole, you know, nemesis-ish situation with Sisko, you know, obviously with the Maquis, but would you guys think he would be qualified as a villain or just another, like, gray antagonist?
Man, Eddington is complicated. Boy.
Somewhere in between, definitely.
He's definitely an antagonist. So Eddington, for anyone who doesn't recall, Michael Eddington, he started the show as kind of a glorified extra. He was a security guard who got assigned to sort of watch over Odo. And they'd already done this once before, and that guy had lasted like two episodes and was clearly just a big goofball. And Eddington was a little bit more competent and kind of in the background. Like, he was never, like, really involved with any of the main characters. He was around. Like, the biggest thing that he did was sabotage the Defiant because some admiral, like, knew Sisko was going to disobey his orders and was like, hey, Eddington, I need you to sabotage the Defiant so Sisko won't disobey my orders. Which is
hey,
kind
Eddington,
of...
there's a fun phrase we don't get to say enough. Hey, Eddington, why don't you go screw everything up? Join the Maquis or something.
Well, yeah, that's what kind of reminded me when we're talking about Sloane. That made me also think of Eddington, where like the threat, the bad guy, the opposition comes from within. Because in this case, you get the extra sense of betrayal. Whereas like you were one of us, you're supposed to be doing what we want, you know, like mindedness. And then it's like, oh no, now we got to fight you.
I always found it hilarious that the crew of Deep Space Nine was really irritated with him because he wasn't willing to be as disloyal as they were. but then, of course, he joins the Maquis, kind of like, you know, in a very surprise move. And then we have another episode where they track him down. And then the last one he appears in is the one where he dies, where he and Sisko kind of team up to, like, find the last survivors of the Maquis, although Sisko thinks they're stopping, like, missiles from attacking Cardassia and, like, starting the war early or what have you. So, with Eddington, I was like, when I first watched Deep Space Nine, I was like, yeah, Eddington, he's a bad dude, you gotta put him away. And then I watched it again, and I was like, man, Eddington's got, like, a point. Sisko's being, like, kind of a huge jerk. I think I'm on Eddington's side now. And then I've watched it again, more recently, and like, even though Sisko is being a huge jerk, and I take real issue with the way Sisko gets Eddington, like the way he catches Eddington, which is basically by setting Eddington's house on fire. He's like, hey, Eddington, this planet that has got Maquis people on it, I'm gonna poison it, and if you don't come over, I'm gonna poison another one. And like, okay, I have a really hard time believing Starfleet would be okay with that.
Well, and that's just a quick side note in that regard. I kind of took it where Sisko was almost becoming like closer to like the Ahab, you know, with like Picard, where it's like a personal vendetta, not like I'm doing the principles of this is what Starfleet would want me to do, but feeling personally betrayed and like, you know, one-upped, and almost like that's why it was like shades of not the movie Nemesis, but like a personal nemesis where it's like...
I love how we have to establish that. Not the movie.
Well, never, you know, because the title, but I mean, obviously we see Picard and Lily in First Contact. It was the movie with the whole, you know, you're just out for revenge. Where's your Starfleet principles type of thing? That's kind of where I took it with Sisko, with Eddington. It's not like I'm going to be the best Starfleet officer in these actions. Sisko was looking at it, you know, coming from a personal vendetta point where it's like that's always, you know, not good, but I kind of could see it where in one hand the Maquis and Eddington are going like from a perspective of Starfleet, like you're going against Starfleet principles and ethics and morals, but then there's also the layer of feeling personally betrayed, like, you know, not just, oh, that's just some Starfleet guy from another ship and he's doing bad things so we got to stop him. It's like he was from the family, like internal, the DS9 crew. Now you're going to go do that? Like, and you know, kind of, so it was just another thing, but because Eddington wasn't really just saying like, I just want all the riches in the world and, you know, everybody to fear me twirling their mustache. Like, would he still be a villain, or is he like the antagonist that has like layers that are semi-sympathetic, or, you know, that's like another good character, but that's also good writing where the villain is not just one-dimensional, where you could kind of see their point or see their motivations, even though you wouldn't agree with it. But that was what I loved about DS9, is so much characterization.
Let me tell you about my journey of Eddington, all right? So, like...
Tell us.
So Eddington is like, the Maquis in general are, at first, they seem to be a pretty legitimate group. Like, they clearly formed in reaction to the Cardassian government, not just the local Cardassian civilians, but the Cardassian government attempting to force humans out of the DMZ, like, by force. Not just humans, Federation citizens, attempting to force them out by force, by creating violence and, you know, funneling weapons into the DMZ and creating this situation where the colonists would have to leave or be killed. And so, and Starfleet just completely failed to protect the colonists. Like, the Starfleet was just busy elsewhere. They were not interested. As far as they were concerned, the peace treaty was signed. They could move on. And that's, like, okay. Like, honestly, I really sympathize with the Maquis in that situation. But when Eddington takes over, he has his whole, like, you know, noble on a crusade thing, and I think he believes it, but his method is...
Yeah, he's got his whole Jean Valjean thing going on.
His method is basically ethnic cleansing. He's like, there's no way we can live in peace with the Cardassians. I will force all Cardassians out of these areas, and then it will just be us. And granted, and the episode talks about this, like he could do it in a nice way, effectively. He's like, hey, they're like, both of them, both Sisko and Eddington, they, like, poisoned these planets. But the implication is that somehow this poison gives them enough time to evacuate, which doesn't seem very likely to me. I have a very hard time believing that nobody died in either of those attacks, because moving large civilian populations is notoriously difficult, like, even in Star Trek. So, like, Eddington, I think, very clearly crosses the line. He's no longer a freedom fighter. He's not fighting to protect people. He is, like, those Cardassians, all of them. I don't care if any of them ever personally did anything bad. I'm forcing all of them out, you know? And so, it's complicated. Like, saying it's complicated, I don't think even does it justice. It gets into, like DS9 didn't want the Maquis. Like, they invented the Maquis for Voyager. And you can tell Deep Space Nine had its sights set on other stories. But you could have done, like, an entire season, an entire show even, dealing with the complexities of having different ethnic groups living in the same area and being in conflict with each other and how hard that is to solve. And God, have we figured that out? Like, have we noticed that as a country recently? I find it interesting that they brought it up, but I wish they had developed it more. That's my long-winded Eddington story.
Well, and it was to set up Voyager, but also we saw that it bled over to TNG because they wanted to have Ro come over to DS9, but then that didn't happen. But I was just thinking, like, over the course, like, when you were describing Eddington and the Maquis, I thought there could have been so many different directions that they could have shown that, you know, without changing anything, just, like, stuff they didn't show that could have been shown and would have been interesting to see. But also, if things were slightly different, I thought... Well, what if Eddington himself were Bajoran? That could kind of maybe give him a reason to go after all the Cardassians. But then I thought, well, but, you know, there's other Bajoran storylines going on with, you know, Kira and other stuff and her rebel friends. But then I thought, okay, what if he was, like, similar to O'Brien, where he was at the same war that O'Brien went through, where in that one TNG episode where he's singing with the captain, was it Setlick 3 or I forget the name of the battle, but, you know, that battle where O'Brien said he had to kill Cardassians and he didn't like what they made him do. But we could see that Miles went through that, but then kind of came out in a good way after it. He's still going to have to deal with, you know, the trauma of it, but he still went to be a good guy path. What if Eddington or, you know, another one, but in this case, Eddington, had that same battle, but then kind of never got over the grudge and went, you know, deeper with it, then that could have been like, well, he joined the Maquis.
Good point.
Or he could have joined the Maquis, not just to be a freedom fighter, but to, like, we need to make them pay, or we need to get back at them. There are just so many different directions and layers to the Maquis that, you know, even in general, like, even on Voyager, like, were they villains that got turned into good guys, or were they gray? Like, the Maquis could have been so much. I wonder, maybe somebody in the chat room or in listening, are there any really good books, novels, just diving into the whole Maquis, not just touching on it, but, like, really delving into those issues. But Sloan and Eddington, that's another example where it's like they're not crazy aliens from a different culture. They're not just, you know, warlike, but they're humans from Starfleet that turn in different directions and kind of become, at very least, an antagonist, or for a while, they're the big bad. They're the villain.
All right. So I think we are about out of time this week. We went a little late because we started late and had that weird, like, technical thing in there. But I think we are, we have finished Deep Space Nine for the most part. We have gotten through Deep Space. Sorry, go ahead.
Again, villain or antagonist, which one would you apply to Liquidator Brunt? We haven't touched on Brunt.
Villain, because he likes making people suffer.
Yeah, there's
Combs.
Liquidator Brunt he's in it for himself, but he also has like an ideological agenda, like definitely. He is all about, he's trying, he hates Quark because he sees Quark as like everything that's wrong with Ferengi society. And he also wants to, like, increase his own power. So he's just very, very interesting. I would put him in the villain role. He's like a side villain. He isn't, like, a threat to the main, to, like, Deep Space Nine itself. But he is definitely, like, hounding Quark, even when it doesn't make sense for him to do so.
And relishing it. You could almost imagine him twisting his mustache, even though he don't really have one. But, yeah, I would probably lean more towards villainy than just it. But... So we're going to wrap it up, right? I think we have to say, to finish off, the worst possible creepy, bad, you know, demented, the worst reoccurring villain on DS9 would be the collective of the Voles. Those darn Voles, they keep coming back. We can never get rid of them.
They're Voles! Always
getting into the
electric. Cardassian Voles.
Yeah.
Take those phasers off, stun. No more Mr. Nice Guy.
They even had little spoons on their heads.
It makes me think everything from there must have spoons on their heads.
Everything on Cardassia has a little spoon on its head in some shape or form. Even spiders. Even the amoebas.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening this week. Join us next week when we finally finish our discussion of recurring villains with Voyager and Enterprise. They have fewer ones, so I think we can get through that in 1 week. Until then, thank you for listening. This has been All Things Trek, signing off.